Some of this may seem relatively new to you, but it's older than Christianity. How we're praying. This is how the Jews prayed for hundreds and hundreds of years, long before Jesus was born on this earth. Of course, he was born from all eternity, but before he was born in time from Mary, the Jews prayed the Psalms 5 times a day. And they would do it relatively like this, kind of singing in a choir back and forth. And this is how they would meditate on the law of the Lord. You can hear this in our responsorial Psalms. And we have continued this tradition in the church, so much that we barely notice it. In fact, the way we celebrate the Mass is a mixture of two fundamental Jewish institutions, the synagogue and the temple. The synagogue is a more recent development in Jewish life, where mostly the Pharisaical movement would allow for the people of God to have the intimacy of his word in their local communities. And so they would read the word, they would meditate on it, they would have conversations about it. And then later on, they would go to Jerusalem for whatever feast was happening to go on, and they would offer their sacrifices in the temple. And both of those things represented the fullness of the Jewish life, the feasts, the important feasts that Jesus recapitulates in himself throughout his ministry, and especially if you read the Gospel of John, they're constantly articulated during the Feast of Booths, during the Feast of the Atonement, during the Feast of Passover, during the Feast of Passover, during the Feast of Passover, he goes through all the different feasts in the Jewish history. And what he does is he recapitulates them by saying, their purpose is what I'm about to do for you. But those feasts also had limitations. And the Jewish people knew those limitations. They knew them profoundly, more than we suspect. And one of the great things that has happened in the last few decades, when Christians and Jews are able to get along better than they have, is we have learned how indebted we are to them. Very, very indebted. Not just because of the fact that Jesus is born from the Jewish people, but as Jesus himself says, salvation is from the Jews. It's in the Gospel of John as well. That salvation is from them because they give us the human context. And there is one thing that scared the Jewish people more than anything. I'm going to say scared, that's a bad word, but gave them a certain level of, okay, let's just shelve that. We'll table that for the next meeting. And that was death. Death itself. Because they knew that God is the source of life. That God is a God of the living, not of the dead. That God did not make death, nor does he rejoice in the death of the living. But it was through the devil's envy that death entered the world. That's actually a direct quote from the Old Testament. That sin makes death happen. That humanity is now separated from the source of her life, the source of her joy. And as a result, death reigns in us. And this is why we can be enslaved. This is why we're afraid to do good, to love, to be tender, to be kind. Because we're afraid of rejection. We're afraid of the pain. We're afraid of all the things that might happen to us if we decide to give a damn. And so we harden our hearts. It's too dangerous to love. It's too dangerous to care. I'm just going to settle for a nice, simple career, get on with my life, and hopefully everybody else will be able to fend for themselves. And here's the thing. What else can you expect? There's no way of fixing the problem of death in this world. And that was why the Jewish people didn't want to touch it. They knew that every time they tried to fix the problem, they did worse. The classic example is the Witch of Endor. When you have Saul, he wants to find out what's happening, that he's losing his kingdom, so he consults a witch who raises the dead spirit of the prophet Samuel and says, "What's going on? I keep seeming to lose all these different battles. What's happening?" Well, he brings the prophet back from death, and then the prophet in this empty shade kind of says to him, "God's left you, man. Because of what you've done, God has left you." And that every time death is consulted among the people of Israel, it doesn't end well. The worst example would be human sacrifice. That if I'm afraid of death, then I will kill you, or worst of all, kill our own children to prevent ourselves from suffering the fate that we're afraid of. Poverty, loss of our kingdom, whatever. That this human sacrifice becomes the symbol or the moment where they all realize the horror that is lurking within the human heart. And the fact that it is so readily tempting, the fact that it almost feels like a necessity, is why we have the story of Abraham. You ever notice that there is that weird paradox in that story where God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son, and then God says, "Don't do it"? Most people, sane people, think this is a weird reading. And it gets increasingly perverse when we try to explain it away. I have read umpteen explanations of this passage that often make it worse and God more diabolical. And you notice that for the Jewish people who insisted on putting it there, they insisted on it. They give no commentaries on it whatsoever. Go throughout the Old Testament, you will not find anyone trying to say, "Now this is the spiritual meaning of the whole thing." Because they knew that every guy who talked like that was a maniac. That it just needed to be endured. And it has in itself, at the very heart of it, a very pattern that love demands all. You can't love without being willing to die. But what good is it to love when you're dead? To quote the Psalms again, "From death, who can praise you?" So God, we need to die to show you that we love you, and then that's pointless, and now they're stuck in a weird tension. They can't love God completely, and yet not loving God completely, they're not really alive. That's the human condition, and there is no escape from it. There are many different explanations where we try to explain it away, where the Egyptians would then say, "Well, not all of us can be saved, but at least eternal life can be given to the Pharaoh. So let's destroy everyone else's life so that he can get by." Or let's worship the rich. Let's worship the powerful. And in our modern despair, we have gone right back into that. We don't think that life is available for us, so at the very least, let's just be really involved with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. That death has settled in, and there is no real understanding of what we can do. There's only one answer. Silence. Patient. Waiting. I made the invitation for you to come here on the presupposition that many of us have encountered or felt tragic deaths. And I'm pretty sure that in the midst of it, you sought an answer and you didn't want one. Anytime somebody tried to give you an easy answer, you might have wanted to punch them. You might have wanted to scream at them and tell them, "Just shut up, please." I still remember when my dad died and I go to Toronto for his funeral in the church where he was the minister. And I found myself consoling the people more than the other way around. So they're all coming up to me and it's like, "Well, you know, he was a good man and he's in a better place." But I was just like, "Yeah, thank you. But you could tell that they didn't even believe it when they were saying it. By saying it, they were trying to convince themselves that this is true. And because they were strangers to me, all of their words meant nothing. Now, I could have spoke to them as the man that I hopefully intended to be, which is a Christian who consoles others. But to me, in my grief, they were useless. And so I mentioned yesterday in our Good Friday service that on a Friday, God made man. On a Friday, God made man from the dust of the earth. And on the Friday, God remade the pattern of man according to human contribution, which is the scourged Jesus. God wants our participation in our recreation. And sometimes all we can contribute is violence. But God has an amazing skill where he is able to take things that are horrible and to transform them into something beautiful. My favorite example is when Paul says that I consider all things as rubbish compared to the glory of God and the knowledge of his resurrection. And I mentioned on the Sunday that when that reading was given, that Paul actually uses the word for poop in very graphic language. And it smells horrible, it's unpleasant to talk about, and it's one of the few things that which I will censor myself. But it's really good fertilizer. The barren cross, the barren tree, needs something. And it's the world's refuse. And this is precisely what God will do to transform and to recreate humanity. But he does one more thing than on Good Friday. Good Friday, he forms the pattern. On Saturday, he does what I consider to be his greatest work, but the one it is really difficult to name and it's really difficult to envisage. He rests. He lies in sleep, in death, with those who have died. And those who have died in the midst of human hopelessness. He takes the hopelessness of death itself and makes it the hope that we need. We don't need an answer. We need a friend. We need somebody who has been through everything we've been through. And the most profound pain is the feeling of hopelessness. That is something God freely accepts. Because he makes that infinite gulf, that separation between God and us that sin has created in this world, and he makes it the way in which we can see his Father. It's very easy for us to say that Jesus is God, but then we forget that he's God in relationship. That Jesus waits in the tomb for his Father to raise him up. And he's pretty clever. He grabs Adam and all of us with him by the wrist and takes us up with him as he conquers death. Christians have become slightly languid over the last few centuries because we stopped proclaiming this mystery. We wanted to have a positive view of creation, and we wanted things to be kind of happy, clappy, and nice. The result was it didn't help us understand depression. It didn't allow us to understand anxiety. It didn't allow us to understand fear or all of the things that go with it. God knows them. And in the midst of those sufferings, you will find God's hand touching you. But remember, when his hand touches you, it's not a smooth hand. It's got a holiness.